Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. In this episode, Jamie Morris talks with Hampton Sides about his book, The Wide, Wide Sea, Imperial Ambition, First Contact, and the Fateful Final Voyage of Captain James Cook. While remaining a narrative work, it is biographical and uses biographical techniques, making of enormous interest to writers and fans of biography. It was published by Doubleday in April 2024. This interview was recorded on March 7th, 2024 via Zoom.
Hampton, thanks for doing this interview. Tell us how you came to write about Cook. And secondly, when you did decide to write about Cook, why did you focus on his final voyage rather than, say, his first?
Oh, it's good to be with you, Jamie. The half facetious answer to the question, why Cook, is that he went to a lot of really nice places. You know, French Polynesia, New Zealand, Australia, Alaska. And I've done a lot of books that required travel to places like Siberia and North Korea. My wife facetiously said, why don't you pick a subject that has research travel that it actually involves some places I'd like to join you. I've been interested in Cook really since I was a little kid. My parents gave me this entire collection of hundreds and hundreds of comic books called Classics Illustrated. And I was like 6, 7, 8 years old, and I feasted over that comic book and, you know, all these lurid pictures of battles on the beach and references to cannibalism and all sorts of things in the South Seas. And, you know, it just captured my fancy at an early age. As I began thinking about a biography or a book about Captain Cook, you know, he had 3 monumental voyages around the world. Each one was equally important and big and consequential and interesting. But from a narrative point of view, writing about all 3 of his voyages would just be exhausting, I think, to the reader and to the writer too. You know, it's like they go out and they come back, then they go out again and they come back, and then they go out a third time. And so I began to think, well, why don't I figure out which, you know, maybe one of the 3 voyages? And as an American writer with an American publisher and an American readership, it was a no-brainer that it would be the 3rd voyage, his final voyage, because they leave England in July of 1776, just as the American Revolution is getting started. There's a whole bunch of American-born people on board the ship, including some of the very high-ranking officers. And their objective is to go to the backside of America, as they call it, which is the mostly uncharted coast of what we now call Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, and Alaska, and to try to find the fabled Northwest Passage, the great passage that the British had been obsessed with finding for so long, but to try to find it from the Pacific side of the ocean, up and over Canada, somehow find that shortcut over the North American continent. Along the way, they stumble upon this amazing archipelago, Hawaii. So much of the action of this book happens in present-day America. It's an American story. It's a British voyage, but it's an American story through and through. Well, not only that, the 3rd voyage was the longest, the most ambitious of all of his voyages, and it's certainly the most dramatic, because it's no spoiler to tell readers that things come back to Hawaii and things do not go well for Captain Cook, and he meets a very, very dramatic end. And I would say the last 3rd of the book is about that dramatic end. How and why did it happen? You know, it all happened on the shores of the Big Island of Hawaii.
Your description is a great pitch to read the book. Question I have to ask you is, why should we? Why should we care about Cook?
Because he's so controversial today. I love it when I can stumble upon a historical subject that's hundreds of years old, but is in the news. If you just Google Captain Cook these days, I mean, just in the last few months, a number of his statues have been yanked down or vandalized. In Victoria, British Columbia, they pulled down his statue into the harbor. Toppled it into the harbor. Another statue was yanked down recently in Melbourne. He's controversial because he's really become a symbol of colonialism and all the bad things that came in the wake of his voyages. I like to say, and I like to think that it wasn't so much what Cook himself did, it's what came after Cook. Cook was an explorer and a cartographer, primarily. He had some nasty encounters with indigenous people, but for the most part, quite the opposite. He was an unusually sympathetic observer of the cultures that he encountered. He was a kind of a figure of the Enlightenment and believed in impartially observing and documenting what he saw. And his three voyages were characterized by just a huge amount of anthropological understanding that was brought back to Europe. But he's controversial today because he was first. Exploration was always the first phase of colonial conquest. First, you had to find these places, put them on the map, and then comes the occupiers and the navies and the armies and the pathogens and the alcohol and the money and the furriers, the whalers, the missionaries, and all the things that came to systematically dismantle a lot of these traditional island cultures. I lean into that controversy in the book. I mean, it's a traditional narrative history, but I certainly try throughout the book to question the underlying ideas and assumptions behind this voyage and the imperial mindset and colonialism and the larger chess game that was being played between European nations to carve up these last discovered places around the world. You know, I try to infuse the book with as much kind of a modern interpretation as possible. The last thing I would say about why Cook and why should we care is that whatever you may think of him as a man, whatever you may think of his voyages, there was no question that he was one of the greatest explorers of all time. He is in the pantheon. I don't think you can find an explorer who traveled as many miles, documented as many experiences, who mapped as many places. He traveled the full length of the Pacific Ocean, from nearly reaching Antarctica to well above Alaska, you know, from the realm of penguins to the realm of polar bears, as they say. And these voyages produced just massive volumes of art and scientific description of new species, you know, these beautiful folio-sized volumes that emerged from his voyages. So if you care anything about how the modern world came to be, and you care anything about exploration, he is in the pantheon.
Let's expand on the writing aspect of this. You already talked about trying to accommodate the more modern view and trying to reconcile that. But you're also writing an engaging, and it is really an engaging book. And it's got this wonderful narrative thread that wants to make you turn the pages, even though you should be going to bed. What were the considerations when you sat at your word processor and started typing? Are there things about the language that you used? Are there descriptions that you felt, you know, contemporaneous descriptions that don't sound right now when to have a book come out when they're tearing down statues devoted to Cook? I mean, it's an unusual writing challenge. And as I told you once, it made me reminisce to your book about Kit Carson, because Kit Carson's considered both a, you know, a wonderful man and an evil man in the Southwest. And you used to answer, well, it's complicated, and explain that, like most humans, there's several sides to people. So wrap that all together and describe to us how you approach to writing about Cook in this kind of atmosphere that's been so changed in the last decade or so.
One of the things I tried to do is to make this more of an ensemble story. It's not a biography, strictly speaking, of Captain Cook. We don't just hear from Captain Cook in his journals, although we hear plenty from him. There's all these other interesting cats on board these ships, these two ships that went on this voyage. And I tried to quote from the journals, who are often critical of their captain. Some of these were journals that were done secretly without the official approval of the British government. And some of them are very critical of their captain. A second thing I tried to do is bring in as much of the oral history of indigenous people that he encountered along the way as I could. Oral history is tricky. Sometimes you're talking about someone trying to remember what their great, 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 great grandfather did or grandmother, and it's not that reliable from a strictly documentary point of view. But nonetheless, I do use it. I hope I use it fairly and respectfully and judiciously, but I try to incorporate as much oral history, and some of that is very much a critique of Cook as well. I'm also just questioning, you know, there's just so many things about that age, the imperial age, that is being reinterpreted, and there's a reckoning going on. It has been across so many spheres of public life, completely justified and way overdue, I think. And so I try to question, like, when they say they've discovered a place, Well, Polynesians have been there for hundreds, if not thousands of years in some cases. There as the result of incredible voyages and incredible navigation skills of their own. So maybe don't use the word discover. I try to be very careful about I'm not saying that he discovered Australia or he discovered, these parts of New Zealand and acknowledge what came before. One of the things that's interesting about Cook is that he was one of the very first to acknowledge what came before. He didn't call himself the discoverer of most of these places. He would sometimes say he was the first European discoverer. If he found out an indigenous name for a place, he used that and put that on the map. If he didn't find that name, he named things after his various superiors at the Admiralty back in England.
Navigate British politics and in indigenous politics.
Yes, at the same time, that's why we got the Sandwich Islands, which is what Hawaii was called for so long. That was Lord Sandwich, the first Lord of the Admiralty, who was supposedly the inventor of the sandwich. Because he was always in a hurry, so he stuck to a piece of meat between two pieces of bread and called it dinner. And he's certainly one of the background characters in the book. Writing about something that's nearly 250 years old, this is certainly the farthest back in time that I've gone with any of my books. People back then were atrocious spellers. There wasn't a regular orthography. Capital letters and weird spellings and a lot of yees and ampersands and things that can trip up your eye and your ear. And so I put in the author's note that I did try to streamline and modernize some of that so that modern readers would be able to just read it, and get it without having to stumble over some antique constructions and things like that. I don't know if that was the right decision, but I do think it makes it more readable.
If they want to see the original, they can fly to England and open up the journal. Your point about, being careful with the word discover relates to something I experienced about, as a white older writer. In the book I wrote about Tony Hillerman, I described Hillerman leaving Albuquerque, driving by Mount Taylor, comma, which the Navajos still called Tzotzil, comma, and the sentence continues. And one of my editors called that settler-centric language. I thought, as an academic, and I thought the more I thought about it, he was right. And it's not a bad description in the sense that I was going from the contemporary rather than saying he passed Tzotzil, which later settlers named Mount Taylor, which is a more fair description. Did you find moments in your work where you suddenly had these ahas where just things that were commonplace constructions for you in writing suddenly took on a different meaning and you had to think through how to express something?
Yeah, I'm sure that happened many times. I should say Cook did go to a lot of islands that were uninhabited, and so therefore he couldn't fall back on
Sure.
local language. Another thing that happened is that when he did try to use local Polynesian place names, often they were to the English ear and eye, they are very long words with many glottal stops, and it's really hard for an English sensibility to get their mind around that word. But he tried, like where he died, the place where he died, Kealia Kukia Bay, is a word, Kealia Kukia, that seems to be pronounced about 50 different ways by different people. But it's a complicated word. It means pathway of the gods. It is one of probably thousands of place names that he tried to get right, but often he screwed them up in
But how
his.
about you as a writer? How did you handle these place names? Because it's off-putting. It's like reading a book about Russians. You can't pronounce half the characters in the book. As a reader, you visually recognize them.
I would try to use the indigenous place name first if it's a known name and was in existence then. But sometimes if it was a tongue twister, I try to use it sparingly because I don't want to, if I can't pronounce it, how am I going to expect my readers to get it right as well? So I don't know. It's a kind of a case by case thing where you
Sure.
just try to do the right thing and be fair and recognize always that there were people there already. These places had their own contexts and their own stories and lore and mythology, and so I try to always be mindful of that. To his credit, to an unusual extent for his time, I think Cook did too. Most of these explorers and sea captains back then just exploited resources and got the hell out of there, often at gunpoint, and they didn't really care about who these people were or where they came from or how they viewed the world. Cook was one of the unusual ones in that regard.
It's a perfect moment to bring up a follow-up question. It isn't a biography, it's a narrative work, and you have a wonderful cast of characters. Tell us about what were some of your favorites to bring into the book and research.
Yeah, it's not a biography. Cook is certainly the first among equals, I suppose. He's a strong character throughout the whole book, and I guess a large part of the book is about trying to understand why things unraveled for him at the end in his third voyage in Hawaii. I guess it's kind of a murder story or a kind of a forensic analysis of what went wrong in this guy's life. But all these other characters come into play, and I guess my favorite one of all is this Polynesian man named Mai, who was brought to England during Cook's second voyage and lived in London and became a cause célèbre, a true celebrity, and beloved and paraded around in all the salons and out on the estates. He was out hunting birds and learning to play backgammon, and he learned English and became a famous guy. I kind of ended up using him as a kind of a GoPro camera, viewing English society and all of its strangeness from a Polynesian point of view. Try to turn the tables because they're examining him, but he's examining them. And he's kind of going into the heart of whiteness. He meets King George. He meets the very best writers and thinkers and philosophers. He goes to the Royal Society, and we see England from his point of view. Then he becomes a major character in the third voyage because the first part of Cook's mission before he goes to find the Northwest Passage is to deliver Mai back to his home island, Tahiti, and to deliver him with a bunch of stuff to show the people of Polynesia just how great England is. And look at all of our cool stuff. We've got scientific instruments and muskets and tools of all sorts and all these trinkets that he's bringing back from London. And what's interesting about Mai, one of the many interesting things, is that people in England think he must be Tahitian royalty, but he was actually a commoner in what was in Tahitian times a very socially stratified society. You could say he was a nobody. He was just a guy, a commoner, who really had come to England because he wanted to learn all about guns and how to fire them. And he wanted to procure as many of them as possible because he wanted to prosecute a war against the people of Bora Bora, who had stolen his family's land. And it was all this vengeance. This is a vengeance story, really. He wanted to kill as many Boraborans as possible and gain back his family's land on his island, which was a place called Raiatea near Tahiti. Anyway, the story of Mai becomes an important story on many fronts. I wanted to have a Polynesian character, and here's one who is arguably one of the most studied indigenous people in English history. He was analyzed and studied, and the best portrait painters painted his portrait called The Portrait of Mai that Joshua Reynolds did was recently sold to the Getty for $62 million. Mai is still famous today. I would say he is my favorite of all the characters, but there's a lot of others, including John Ledyard, an American who was on board the ship and witnessed everything and wrote very interestingly about it.
I was struck when you introduced him that we kind of forget, because we travel so easily now, that the idea of him leaving Tahiti and going to England is somewhat similar to, an astronaut in the Apollo landing on the moon. Somebody says, "Can you give me a ride back to your Florida state? I want to meet." It's not a casual voyage. I mean, what was his sense of the world to get on a ship, captained by these odd-looking people, I'm looking from the Polynesian point of view, and go to this society halfway around the world.
Yes, and he was the very first Polynesian to do that. So he had no idea what he was getting into, or how far away England was, or who these people were, the English. So it was a pretty brave thing that he did, a pretty bold and brave thing, even though he comes from a culture that knows all about long distance voyaging. They had settled the entire, as they call it, Polynesian Triangle, and from Easter Island to New Zealand to Hawaii. But he had never been on a voyage that long with such strange people, and he was homesick much of the time, and it took him a long time to learn some English and make friends and all that. But he did, and it's a remarkable story.
Let's talk a little bit about the research. I know that one member of your household, your wife, was thrilled with the idea that you were going to head off to nice warm places. I know you also spend time, like most of us, in archives with white gloves, carefully turning pieces of paper. Aside from keeping your wife happy, what's the point to going to these places 250 years later where they don't look the same? I mean, what do you get as a writer from that moment of landing landing in an airport rather than on a beach and all of the different things that you're researching?
I find that I have a lot more confidence when I'm writing a scene set in a place. If I've been to that place, I feel like a phony sometimes if I'm trying to write about someplace that I just have no idea what it looks and feels like. You do have to do a lot of squinting. Tahiti today does not look like what it looked like in Cook's time. Roads and cars and motorcycles and boats and so forth. But the topography is still there, and the layout of these islands and their proximity to each other, and a million little details that can enter into your scene painting. That's one part of it, I guess. Another part of it is just when you're at a cocktail party or something, and someone who's talking to you and you've never been introduced, and you for some reason never introduce yourself, and that relationship is just kind of provisional and hanging there, like, who is that guy? Like, that's the way I feel about it. If you're not grounded in a place and you haven't been properly introduced to that place with a little bit of scene painting, a little bit of sense of the weather or the geography, then you feel like you're left hanging there as a reader. I like to be introduced, not just to the people, the characters in my story, but the places. The quickest way to do that is just physically go there when you can. Unfortunately, Cook went to so many damn places, even just on his third voyage. There's no way I could go to them all in terms of finances. And I was trying to do this all during the time of COVID, so there was a lot of restrictions and a lot of places I couldn't get to. But I went to as many as I could afford to get to. And let's just be honest, it's also just the fun part of doing these books. I love travel. I love to go to different places. And whenever possible, also to meet local people who are indigenous people who might have stories to tell that have been passed down through the generations. So those are all some good reasons for travel. There does come a time, though, when the book is due and you just have to hunker down and write and you can't travel anymore. That's the fun is over. And then you got to start making sense of all this stuff.
We've been talking with Hampton Sides. The new book is called The Wide, Wide Sea: Imperial Ambition, First Contact, and the Fateful Final Voyage of Captain James Cook. The title, The Wide, Wide Sea. Where did that come from, and why does it work so well?
Well, it comes from Coleridge, the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, probably his most famous poem. Coleridge grew up steeped in the lore of Cook's voyages. His tutor was actually the astronomer on board Cook's second voyage. And a lot of scholars think that Coleridge was very much influenced by Cook when he wrote Rime of the Ancient Mariner. So it's just a line from a poem. It's expansive. It kind of hints at just the huge oceanic, just the immensity of the voyage. And but it also gets at this larger theme of the book, which is the enormous gulf that separates these cultures from far distant parts of the world. Something that Cook, I think, was grappling with a lot by the time of his third voyage was, it's like, are these voyages good for these people? Are they good for our people? His own sailors. He was starting to have doubts. Many of us have this notion that travel is good and cultures should cross-pollinate, and it's wonderful to, we were all enriched by far-flung travel and adventures like this. But, I think there was an element of Cook's voyage that suggests the opposite, that these voyages are not good for these people. He started to see changes in this, say, for example, people from New Zealand, the Maori were different by the time of his third voyage. Their sense of economy, he saw dislocations of all sorts and in diseases, European diseases that were spreading among the Maori. So I think the Wide Wide Sea kind of connotes this notion of like this huge gulf between cultures that Cook was trying to figure out how to bridge, often unsuccessfully. And really, the circumstances of his death are all about that. Miscues and misunderstandings between cultures that rapidly escalated into a very bloody and very dramatic, violent end for this man's life, Captain Cook. So that's where it comes from. I also just like the rhythm of it. I like the way it sounds. It sounds big. It sounds expansive. I don't know, a little bit majestic.
Your book is a sympathetic and critical look at both Captain Cook and the people around him that I think will enhance modern readers' understanding of that period in a way that is long overdue. Hampton, thank you for your time, and I know our listeners will really appreciate the things you've said.
Thank you, Ben. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
That was Jamie Morris in conversation with Hampton Sides about his book, The Wide, Wide Sea, Imperial Ambition, First Contact, and the Fateful Final Voyage of Captain James Cook. It was published by Doubleday in April 2024. This interview was recorded via Zoom on March 7th, 2024. To learn more about bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. Alani Hodge created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.